Yeah, man. Dave Perry, man. Finally.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, man. I've been doing, you know, Shauna got us connected, and I've been doing, she's been crushing it, and I've been doing a lot of press recently, but I got to admit that I've been looking forward to talking to you for a while. I'm a fan of your show and your approach, and I also have a theory that we are on parallel paths, or that we have a similar approach to, like, achieving, doing what we love without the support of some sort of, like, top tier apparatus. Yeah. That's doing it. You know, like, for me, it would be a record label. For you, it would be some sort of, like, you know, digital network, that, like, a journalism organization or something like that. And right. While that can be discouraging, overwhelming, whatever, like, you have clearly put in a lot of time and effort, blood, sweat, and tears to, like, create a brand for yourself, grassroots stuff, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, all that kind of stuff, to get the type of caliber of people that you have on your show is, I think, strongly reflects a combination of just your, like, acumen for what you're doing, but it also speaks volumes to, like, you as a person. And obviously, like, people wouldn't want to keep coming on your show if you sucked at what you did, or, like, weren't enjoyable to talk to. And I was just revisiting two of your episodes with Clint, and I was really digging the one where Paul is in the beginning of the episode, and I feel like he summarized what he loves about you, and I think other people love about you, is that it's very clear that, like, you come off as a fan in the same way that, like, Matt Pinfield comes off as a fan. Like, you know, he's a genius, but, like, I think it's very clear when someone's approaching a conversation from, like, a journalistic standpoint, and then when someone is, like, you can have journalistic intentions and use journalistic tools, but still be speaking from a more passionate place of, like, this music means so much to me. So connecting with the people who make that music, who have already personally impacted to me, I just think that comes off crystal clear in your interview style. So I really enjoy that, and I've been looking forward to talking to you.
Oh, wow, man. Dude, I feel like you're interviewing me. That was great. Thank you.
I have a tendency of doing that, so feel free to tell me to shut up if I...
No, I love it. No, I love it. I love when you brought up Clint, because I haven't watched those interviews in so long, and they're so hard to watch for me. Do you have... when you put out music, can you go back and listen to it, or do you critique yourself like I do? Like, I can't just enjoy my interviews. Not at all.
I will admit that, and, you know, this is something... I think Clint is great as this as well. I'm going to reference Clint a lot during this conversation.
Look at this,
you know,
man.
Because I know. For sure. I think Clint does an amazing job of walking that line of, he's obviously very serious about his commitment to his artistry and about the business of being a professional musician, especially for, like, 3 decades. And this is how he feeds his family. Like, in all of those regards, he takes it very seriously. But he also doesn't take himself too seriously as an artist. And I think that's very clear in his social content, in his stage presence, when he does, like, walk in the streets at night, whatever, but he can also do stuff that, like, is gut-wrenching, heart-wrenching, soul-crushing level of intimacy and vulnerability. And, you know, I aspire to walk that line as well. So, but to answer your question, not only am I my biggest critic, but, like, I will admit, and this is just part of, like, having this level of vulnerability and really not caring about how other people perceive it, which is really even just, like, what the name Fear of Water is about, like, being true to yourself. You know, the human body is composed of, like, 70-80% water. And I've just always been so inspired by this resistance in Western culture to, you know, you can acknowledge what's mainstream and what's popular and what's accepted and what's comfortable. That's fine. But to feel compelled that you need to adhere to that to be accepted, and especially if you feel like your true inner self is polar opposite of that, then you, like, repress that and push that down. Unfortunately, I think way too many people, especially in our generation, fall prey to that. And it's like a constant reminder to me to not do that. So one of those things is that I'll admit that pretty much every year for, like, the last 6 years, when I get my Spotify Wrapped, my top artist is me. Like, I listen to my own music.
That's great.
Constantly. Part of it is because my goal, if a song, one of my songs will never see the light of day if it's not something that I love. And obviously I am biased, but also I am my biggest critic. So there's tons of stuff that will never see the light of day because I hate a variety of different aspects about it. But, like, you know, it's I think what you were alluding to, not watching those episodes in a while, is that you feel like you have evolved since then, obviously your production studio and quality. So like, I encourage you to not do that. If for no other reason, it helps you keep perspective. It helps you appreciate the evolution. It helps you appreciate the conversation we're having right now to see what you were doing in 2020. And you're still pulling guests like Clint Lowry in 2020. So like, if for no other reason, and similar for me on a parallel path, what I was doing in like 2019 is recording at home. I wasn't going to Nashville. I wasn't working with multiple producers that were doing number one songs and working with tons of artists that I respect. I wasn't collaborating with Clint Lowry and Elias Soriano and Heidi Shepherd from Butcher Babies and Aaron Nordstrom from Gemini Syndrome. But I never want to lose sight of the fact that I was just a guy making internet videos. And that just remembering all of the gas that went into that tank, all the different things that inspired me and influenced me to keep taking these progressive steps of like, okay, I want to elevate to the next level. And I want to continue to evolve. I'm going to invest more in this. I'm going to get this piece of gear. I'm going to try this musical style. I'm going to cover this song, even though I'm intimidated by it. Like, I think you should go back and watch those episodes, man. I think there's something to be learned.
Thank you. Good Lord. I'm going to do it now or after this interview.
Yeah, let's stop right now and watch it together.
Pause. Yeah. Just comes up on the screen. Mm-hmm. When you mention all these great people you've collaborated with, you know, where does that begin? Where is that where you have fear of water and you're like, hey, I'm just going to, you know, connect with all the people I love, you know, but like all the people you love. Me and you love the same people, but.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of crossover there.
How does that start? Who's the first person that you got that was big?
So where it starts from is just when there are several of these songs that I've written that when I'm writing them, and this is just like pie in the sky. I knew none of these people. I had no connection to them before I made contact with them and got them on board. And so there was a lot of cold calling there. There's some scenarios where someone vouched for me and got us connected. But at the end of the day, you know, the music has really had to stand on its own. Like all of these artists at the end of the day need to be like, do I want my name attached to not only this song, but this person who I really don't know anything about, you know, for the rest of my career.
Yeah.
I would never blame an artist for deciding no in that scenario. Obviously anyone who's at a Clint Lowry level or Elias Soriano, people have been doing this for almost three decades. People who have gone from the height of the music industry when it was the most profitable thing, you know, late 80s, early 90s, and then survived the complete destruction of the music industry with the introduction of Napster and have evolved into what it is today. You needed to be meticulous and strategic and methodical. So I would never blame someone for if I reached out to them and be like, hey man, you don't know me. I'm just a very passionate guy who can play a bunch of instruments. If you want to do something with me, I would never blame someone for being like, this doesn't work with my plan, my strategy. Yeah. Like I don't know you. Like if it's not something that elevates them as like, there's a wide variety of reasons why I would understand why someone wouldn't work with me. But what's great is that now I have like five of these collaborations under my belt, and not just the fact that they exist, but like Codependent Parasites with Elias Soriano of Nonpoint did incredibly great well. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And like I was writing it, back to your question, like how does it start? I literally was just writing and be like, man, Elias would sound fucking sweet on that. Like that was it. Not like I got a lead here and I'm going to follow this. It was just like, there was something about it doesn't even necessarily sound like a Nonpoint song, but there was something about the percussive syncopation of the vocals in the verse where I was like, I sound okay doing this. Elias would fucking slay this. And I grew up in Madison, outside of Madison, Wisconsin. Nonpoint has like a deep, deep seated love for that town. Like they will come play JJO 94.1 is the radio station there. They were one of the first bands to really give Statement a fair shot.
And why is that? Why is that?
So I don't like, why was it JJ? Why was it that radio station and not radio stations?
Wisconsin? Like, why is it? Where's the love from? I don't know if you know.
I don't know. Because I actually don't have a whole lot of good things to say about Wisconsin as a like an epicenter of like musical culture. There's a very short list of bands that have come out of Wisconsin. There's really not a lot of great venues, and honestly, there's really not a lot of great radio stations. There's a very few. Like, it's a very red state. It's not a political thing, but just it's very rural. There's a lot of country fans. There's a lot of you know, pop and hip hop has been dominating the entire country, if not the world, for a very long time. And it's just like, and during that time period, you know, we in a 10-year period, we went from Korn regularly being the number one band on TRL to TRL doesn't exist anymore and no one's buying CDs. And like, I just feel like there was a ton of stations that were switching formats. Just what was cool and acceptable was just no longer leaning towards rock. And it's just all the, like a lot of the rock festivals were going away. And it was depressing. Mm-hmm. So it's really cool to see bands like Nonpoint and Seven Dust not only push through that time period, but they're kind of at the top of their game still, and doing incredible things. I just think that there was good. I don't know who, but like, I really think it came down to like some individuals within JJO who just heard the potential in that band. And I do not think it's something that is reflective of like the culture of Wisconsin. That being said, they have built an enormous fan base in Madison and they can go anytime that they come there, they are going to sell out whatever show that they're playing or whatever. So I've been fortunate enough to see Nonpoint 40 times, something like that.
Same here, dude.
Yeah. And I love them. And fortunately, like the Nonpoint and Seven Dust path has been very parallel. Like I've seen them play together. They were releasing music around the same time. They are similar genre, but very distinct in their own ways. And yeah, so, you know, I've very briefly interacted with Elias through like, you know, meet and greets or like talk to him for 2 minutes on Shiprocked here and there. But like, I would never expect him to remember who I am. And, you know, I was very fortunate to have the channels to get this song that I created with Kyle O'Dell out of Nashville. Basically, I went down there in 2023. That's what it was, with a batch of songs and, you know, that I wrote at home and recorded at home. And it's like, I want you to like turn this into polished awesomeness that can be like octane ready, because I'm not capable of doing that at home. And like I said, at the end of the day, he didn't know me from any other fan. And it just really came down to like, do you like the song? Like, can you envision your voice being on the song? Do you want your name and your brand associated with this? And not only did he do the song, but I consider him a friend now. Like, we talk on a regular basis. He's gotten me involved in other creative endeavors. He's been a huge participant in the like promotion of the song and the video. And like, he's just been like a huge champion of what I'm doing. And I would say a very similar thing about all of the other people that I've had the chance of working with. And I'm incredibly grateful, because I don't think any of them truly realize the amount of momentum that they have given me to just do what I'm doing now at a level that I've dreamed about since high school. Long time coming. It's been great,
though. You know, when you mentioned the video you did, you're playing all the instruments yourself in the video, right?
Yeah, so, but I need to specify that, like, for, I would strongly encourage people to look up Codependent Parasites by Fear of Water on YouTube. Not only am I playing all the instruments, I'm in a room with myself. So not like four different frames. It's four clones of Dave standing next to other Daves. And the director did a phenomenal job of like piecing
amazing
that all together. I was really, really happy with how that turned out.
When I watched it, I was like, at first I didn't get it. I was just like, oh, that's
they
cool.
Look very similar.
Who's that guy? Yeah. And who's the guitar? They're the same people. Yeah, exactly.
It's the same dude. And that's the thing, man. Like, I want that to be my point of differentiation. I'm participating in a very crowded space, and there's a ton of incredible bands out there. Not a lot of people doing what I'm doing. And for better or for worse, like, in a sense, it gives me a point of differentiation that I'm this guy that you've never heard of without a professional, you know, record label or a management company, making music with incredible people behind the scenes and partnering up with incredible people who, you know, who are industry or, you know, genre defining. And I feel like what I'm achieving on my own gives me confidence about like the music industry as a whole and like what independent artists can achieve if you have the dedication and perseverance. I mean, I literally have 20 years of like no's, of false starts, of basically just going nowhere whilst continuing to hone my musical craft and working on songwriting and learning new techniques, and obviously consuming as much as music as possible to inspire me while still refining my own like specific Fear of Water sound. But like, I easily could have given up a very long time ago, because this has made me, you know, for a very long period of time, it not only did it make me no money, it cost me a tremendous amount of money. And, you know, playing a show on a Tuesday night to, you know, basically just the sound guy, the bartender and the other band, you know, like there's a lot of demoralizing steps that can happen along the way to getting any kind of momentum whatsoever. And a lot of our favorite bands that we're talking about have also gone through those phases, right? It's not like Seven Dust was just immediately amazing. Like they had to, they had to
work,
grind it out. One of the things that I remember so specifically about them in the early days is that, and maybe you remember this, they bought like infomercial airtime.
Yes.
You remember this? At like 3 a.m, you could go to like Channel 4 and it was like TVT Records presents Seven Dust. And it was this really cool, like live, they bought like an hour of, infomercial space.
That was the smartest thing their record company did. TVT was to buy that little piece.
Before they disappeared. I thought it was, it definitely solidified it for me. Like, to be honest, even just like hearing that Lejean was black was like that, it, you know, it's, there is definitely not enough integration. I think in all genres of music, but like, I've been very happy to see more people of different backgrounds and ethnicities getting into the hard rock and metal game. But like that immediately, I was just like, cool. I mean, I'm in high school when it comes out and I looked at every other band I'm listening to, very few examples of people who weren't white men. So that was cool. And then the song Black is still to this day, like such a fucking banger, dude. It's still, I think, one of their best songs. And then I saw that their live performance, I was like, dude, I saw them so many times on that first round of tours. And that's how I got introduced to Stained and like Skunk Anise and Cold Chamber and like all of these bands that they were touring with. And it's literally been a lifelong relationship with them for me. And as I got to know them better and understood the role that Clint Lauer was playing, he joined the highest echelon of other multi-instrumentalists. Like for my top three is Trent Reznor, Dave Grohl, Clint Lowry. So to be sitting here 20 years later and saying I'm making music with Clint Lowry is like,
unreal.
It's still kind of difficult for me to wrap my head around, but I'm super proud and grateful.
Can you talk a little bit about, I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you. Can you talk a little bit about working with Clint Lowry and the song you sent me, Shame, right? I don't know if we're allowed to say that.
We are 100% able. I have no record label who can tell me what to do or what not to do.
Dude, I love the song. It's so good. Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate you checking it out. I just knew as a fellow Clint Lowry fan and Seven Dust fan that you would at least be interested in hearing it. I think it has elements of... I think it has enough of a Seven Dust flavor that it will be a very easy pill to swallow for Seven Dust fans. But I also feel like it is still, you know, uniquely my defined sound. And this song's called Shame. And, I'm also the drummer for the band Raw. And for, Do You Call My Name? That album also came out when I was in high school. So if you told me that 20 years later, I'd be touring on the 20th anniversary of that album, I'd also say you're full of shit. But working with Sahaj Tikitin, the lead singer of Raw, who's also a very prominent, prolific producer who's worked with a ton of great bands, he was able to basically do an email introduction to Clint. And, we sent him the song. And again, I'm thankful that these people don't owe me anything. There's no like favors that I'm pulling. I have no leverage. There's nothing like that. So it's either like, you either like this or you don't. And I take that as a sign of respect towards what I'm doing. That it's just like it's either yes or no. And the fact that I've gotten yeses, especially from Clint Lowry
So what did he say? He's like, yes, amazing. I love the song. And
he's in the creative atmosphere. Like when it's like getting down to business, he's very chill. And like there's like a quiet intensity there, so he was never like emphatically like, this is a fucking like skull, let's get turn on the gas. But he
that's so true.
I think he saw the potential in it. And I say that because at the point that he got it, it was for all intents and purposes a finished song that we would have just taken my vocals out of a part of the song and then he would have replaced it. What he sent back was like totally different. He even like changed. He's like, just so you know, I took out the chorus and I wrote a totally different chorus and I played guitar and drums. He like did the Clint Lowry treatment on it, which I didn't ask for, wasn't expecting, but I'm thrilled that he did. And I think that that's really where a lot of the Seven Dust flavor comes from. But yeah, he was really good at not constructive criticism, but like we had a dialogue about it and it evolved and there were multiple drafts of it. And, you know, I'm super proud of how that turned out. And through connecting, through doing that song, it actually led to him co-writing three of the next songs that I ended up doing with Kyle O'Dell. So those haven't come out yet. And those aren't Clint features. He just co-wrote the songs with me and his contributions were phenomenal. He hears music very differently than I do, which is great. So like mixing those sauces together, especially from like a vocal melody standpoint, like I would have something in mind, it'd already be written, but I would just send him an instrumental version of something that I recorded and what he would send back. It'd be like a gibberish top line melody where he'd be like, but serious, but just no real words. And I would listen to it like, damn, dude, I would have never heard this fitting into these pockets, like melodically, harmonically, rhythmically, you know, intensity here and vulnerability here. And he elevated all of those songs. So, yeah, man, I feel incredibly fortunate to
be. What a cool process, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I have to say, just to be totally honest, incredibly stressful for me. Like, he didn't criticize me or anything, but I've never felt so critical of myself. Like, holy shit, I'm giving this, especially during the songwriting process. It's like, I'm giving
him
this
unfinished.
Oh, dude, I care about it. I care about how he like perceives me. yeah, man, it's very difficult sometimes to walk that line of like, to turn off the like I'm an enormous lifelong fan switch and just focus, just get into like I'm a peer. You know, we're both musicians. Let's make, you know, that's very difficult for someone who's had a literal lifelong impact on me. So it's been incredible. I think he's proud of how the song turned out. There's no release date yet, but it'll probably be mid to late April because I currently have two singles out right now that we want to let kind of breathe its full life. Like they just got sent out to radio. Codependent Parasites with Elias it was supported by FM stations across the country for 14 weeks, which is almost unheard of for a band that you've never heard of before. And it hit number 10 on the SMR top 50 in February. And I'm like looking at that chart and it's like, I'm spaces away from Disturbed and Avenged Sevenfold and Nickelback and Blink-182 and Green Day and Metallica and then this band you've never heard of before that's like it still blows my mind every week. I would check the charts and like look, oh, went from 47 to 42, went from 42 to 38, went from 38 to 31. Like and again, none of these stations, I have no leverage there, I have no relationships that I'm like pulling favors for. It's just like the music needs to stand on its own and I'm incredibly rejuvenated. It's very easy to be pessimistic about the state of the music industry and the opportunity for independent unknown artists to achieve anything. And this process has been very invigorating, not only for myself, but like, I like sharing my story. I want people to hear this episode and be like, shit, man, like I've been wanting to do something like that. Like, go do it. Like try.
Right. No record company at all. Like zero. You're doing this yourself. That is crazy. Yeah. That reminds me of Nonpoint. I mean, they're doing it on their own now.
Yeah, you know? For sure. And that's so awesome that they have gotten that. And that is actually part of what allowed us to partner in the level that we did partner. Yeah. Where they have complete control 100%. Over that, is that they've created basically their own record label. Like those guys are, and Seven Us too, like they're businessmen. Like they're not just artists. Like the fact that they have, this is what has allowed their longevity and how they've persevered in a very difficult industry is that they have sharpened their business acumen, which is also difficult because they've been doing it since they were like kids, pretty much. Like they didn't get an opportunity to like experience, maybe sharpen their business acumen in like college or in like a traditional work environment or something like that. So like I have a ton of respect for these guys that can survive the ups and downs of a very tumultuous industry and then go on to do things like start your own label. I just have so much respect for both those bands.
Dude, I'm friends with Mikey from Islander, and he was, he had a new song that he's friends with Jacoby from Papa Roach, Jacoby sent him lyrics, and he was gonna feature on a song. Everything was tight, and then record company said nope, and it never happened.
And it'll just that's sitting in a Dropbox file somewhere. So frustrating.
He did the song without him, it just like had to release it without it, and it was like,
man, do you ever listen to the? I'm sure you've listened to this, just knowing you. Have you listened to the Queen of the Damned soundtrack?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's Aaliyah's last.
Exactly. Yeah. But that whole soundtrack was great supposed soundtrack. To be every song was Jonathan Davis. And at the time that that this was early. This is like Kazaa, LimeWire, Napster days.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I have like bootlegs of the all Jonathan Davis versions of that entire soundtrack made it out to the internet, but like label shut it down. And it's frustrating for Korn fans, of which I'm an enormous Korn fan. But what it ended up doing is forcing the soundtrack to become like, okay, Marilyn Manson's singing this song and David Draymond's doing this song and the guy from Edema is doing this song. Like it, they made lemonade out of lemons, but like, anyways, the point is that like, yeah, labels.
I never knew that. That's amazing.
I don't know. They're on like a computer that's dead or something, but like somewhere out there in the ether, there is the entire Queen of the Damned soundtrack, which was written by Jonathan Davis, is also performed by Jonathan Davis, and that never saw the light of day.
So because, cool.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe I really hope that, like, especially with how much it was almost 20 years ago, like, I hope that one day that can officially see the light of day, and Jonathan Davis can be like, no, like, come at me, bro. Like, like, the people want to hear this. Did you see that announcement that they did? I think it was just yesterday about
the 30-year
anniversary.
I saw them during the 25th, the 25th anniversary. I think they came to Atlanta and did the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing.
I got a chance.
I saw him with Fildy, though. That's when I saw him. Nice. I guess Fildy's not going to be on the 30th. I don't know.
I mean, but at this point, it's like, that's the thing. Like, life happens, right? Like, people have families. People, dude, I don't know that I wouldn't be burnt out of touring after 30 years of doing it. And also, if you like lived a pretty heavy party lifestyle at a certain point, like, at this point, I don't blame people for hanging it up or at least taking a step back. Actually, a good example of that is Anne Berlin. Maddie from Memphis Mayfire is doing is going to be their touring vocalist, but the original vocalist of Anne Berlin is just stepping back in terms. He's still the official lead singer. He's going to do the albums, but then Maddie's going to go out on tour with them. Which at first I was like, I can't hear that at all. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with Anne Berlin, but like very different. Different, totally different bands in my mind, but but Maddie's been posting a bunch of like isolated vocal stuff of him singing Anne Berlin. I was like, I kind of like it more. So he's such a good vocalist, and his ability to, because he can like emulate exactly what the singer of Anne Berlin does, but then like also rip it, which Anne Berlin guy either chooses not to or can't. But you know, Maddie can like fucking rage when he wants to. So like for him to like put some stank on some high notes and like really dig in. Kind of gives the song a whole new life. So yeah, I'm very excited about seeing them out there
live. That's cool. I need to check this out. You know, you're mentioning different bands. Nothing More. You're a drum tech. How did this happen? How did you become a drum tech for Nothing More?
It's a funny story. So I'm a huge Nothing More fan. They, among other artists along the way, like, I've always been inspired by progressive music, and that term can be very vague in general, but the core aspect of progressive music that I like is that it is not defined by the structure that most mainstream music tends to stick to, where it's like, and I'll just give some basic examples, like the song can't be more than 4 minutes long and every chorus needs to be an exact same thing and it needs to be super catchy so people are repeating it. Like, it has to be as consumable as possible. And in a lot of scenarios, it's like, if it can sound as much as your previous single or as much as some other number one song, you know, the more the better. And when bands come out, when someone like Periphery or Tesseract, and I would put Nothing More in this category, when they come out with like Spirits on their last album, like the lead single is 7 minutes long and they're not Tool. Like, you don't just automatically get to do that. Like, they're taking swings out there. They want to participate in the world of mainstream rock, but they're not mainstream. And I have a great deal of respect and appreciation for that. Plus, their live performance is insane. So, been a fan since the Few Not Fleeting came out. So, like, basically their first album. And in 2018, I went to a music festival in San Antonio, where they're from. They're not playing the music festival, but I'm wearing a Nothing More t-shirt, and I am chock full of mushrooms, like many mushrooms.
How many? And like, are you talking about a handful or just
no, like 5 grams? So it's called like the hero's journey, where like literally my face is melting off and I'm sweating and I just, you know, so it was fun. So I'm kind of just like wandering through the parking lot where the festival is, and this woman comes up to me and she's like, hey, do you like that band? It's like, oh dude, you've never heard of Nothing? Oh my god, let me tell you. And she's like, hold on. She got real close and she's like, I have a secret, you can't tell anyone, but the guitar player put a baby in me. And I don't know if she could tell that I was super fucked up or whatever. I was like, oh my God, are you okay?
Are you okay?
Does anyone know? And like, as I'm like consoling her, she just like slowly turns my body around and Mark, the guitar player, is standing right behind me. I'm like, oh, do you know her? He's like, yeah, that's my wife. So I was like, oh. And what I thought would have been like a 2 minute interaction of like, hey man, big fan, like cool. And then geek out for 2 minutes. We hung out for like 2 hours. And just like got the three of us and their other friend just got beers and went and watched a bunch of other bands and we exchanged phone numbers. And I was like, holy shit, man. So I like started a friendship with Mark under crazy circumstances.
That is
and
then, so crazy.
Yeah. And then in 2019, I am in Medellin, Colombia. And I get a text from Mark that says, hey, man, I follow you on Instagram. I've been seeing you've been posting pictures from Medellin. Our drum tech fell in love with someone on the tour that we just did, and she's from Medellin. The tour just ended and he's just moving with her impulsively back to Medellin, and he gets there tonight. And I was like, well, actually tonight's my last night. And he said, he's like, I don't know you that well, but I know you well enough that I think you guys would meld perfectly. So I really want you guys to get together. I'm going to give him his phone number. Same thing like with Mark, where I thought it was just going to be like get together for one beer, like, hey man, nothing more. Cool. Nope. That turned into like partying until my plane left the next day, which was a nightmare. I was so hungover, but we had
drunk and hungover.
Yeah. Oh yeah, dude. Yeah. Exactly. And you know, going from South America back to Texas was a nightmare, but I formed a great friendship with Brian Roll is his name. He was the drum tech. Post-quarantine, he needed to step back from being the drum tech to attend to some family issues, and nothing more takes their crew positions very seriously. It's not just like, okay, any drum tech. It's like, no, we've toured with you before. We know you're reliable. You're good at your job. We know that you feel valued and we see value in you. Like they're very intentional and they want the same people for every single tour. So for him to step back, the replacement was a big deal. And, Brian had me come out and go on tour for a few shows with nothing more. And like, so they could also see me like on the bus and like, am I a functional human, let alone just like a musician that understands the job? And yeah, we all kind of just mutually agreed that this is a good fit. We're going to do this. I'd never drum tech before, but I'm a lifelong drummer and fan of the band. So like I had the skill set and knowledge of the music that I was able to step in and do it. The tour was, and the band would absolutely say this without hesitation, the tour was awful. It was one of the worst tours that they've ever done. You know, the Murphy's Law, like whatever bad thing can happen will happen.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Like from the very first show, and this is In This Moment, Sleep Token, nothing more.
And your first gig with them, right? Is it?
Yes,
is it,
absolutely. Yeah.
The worst comes right when you start.
Yep. Yeah. And I couldn't help but feel like it, you know, I'm the factor here. Like right, I'm the only new thing about this, but like, we had three buses break down. We had to fire two bus drivers. We had a guy show up blackout drunk to drive the bus.
Oh, no.
There was another bus driver on the tour that was like he was like sending dick pics to Corey Taylor's wife, who was out with us on tour with the cherry bombs. And she was like, that's totally fucking unacceptable.
Oh God.
And the industries, like the touring industry, is so crazy right now because of everyone who couldn't tour in 2020 and 2021 all went out at the same time in 2022. So there's this massive shortage of buses and even less people to drive them.
Yeah.
So this dude is able to massively offend a pretty important person in our industry. And she's just, the media is like, fuck you, you're done. And he's like, cool, you have 30 minutes to get all of your shit off my bus or I'm driving away. And this should be something that ends a dude's career forever. Like you can't even go be a bus driver in China or whatever. Nope, that dude had a job the next day. It's just insane, the demand. Oh, wow. The total imbalance of just like they're in this incredible position. So there, and there's way more amazing drivers out there who are friends with the bands. And you
is literally he still driving
I don't know about 2 years later. I hope not. I haven't kept up with it. But dude, I mean, other things, like on the way to Aftershock, we hit a fucking bear. A bear on the freeway. We hit a bear like 65 miles per hour, which is like hitting a van. And
everybody okay?
The bear is not okay, I'll tell you that. We, you know, at something like Aftershock, all the bands are supposed to be loaded in and set up at like 8 in the morning. Nothing more playing at like 4. a new truck needed to come out. We needed to swap all of the gear out of the thing that was covered in bear guts into the new truck and then make it to the festival and then navigate through the festival. It's easier to do that when no one's in there at 7 a.m, but this is in the middle of the day. So literally every other crew, this was such like a cool community effort where every other crew member of every band that was performing that day that wasn't busy just all lined up. And it was this an amazing effort of like 75 crew guys, just like, get shit off the truck. And like, we had to have that a full semi packed to the ceiling, totally unloaded, set up, wired properly, sound checked, on a stage, ready to play for 75,000 people in like 30 minutes, which is just unheard of. And we made it work. And it was incredible. But it's just like, everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. We persevered. There were still tons of good shows, but like,
and you survived. Yeah. You made it. I survived.
Yeah. No one died.
I give you a lot of credit right then. They're like, thank you. You didn't do it in the trenches.
And honestly, just part of like, I have no desire. I didn't have a desire and I still don't have a desire. That's, I don't want that to be my profession, but to help execute a live performance of one of my all time favorite bands meant the world to me. And I think that a big way that they repaid that to me is that, on their last show, they sold out the Machine Shop and they had me play with them.
It's on YouTube.
It's on the Fearwater Facebook page. And it was a true bucket list moment for me, performing like, and it, dude, it's awesome. In the video, Johnny's like, we've never done this before. We have never practiced with this guy before and fuck it. We're just going to try it. And the crowd's like, Dave. And then Johnny's like, do you really want it? And then just fucking kicks in. And like, I got goosebumps thinking about it, man. Like, it was so fucking rad.
So were you talk about when you were on there, were you nervous, just excited? Yes. I mean, you knew the song. Dude. Yeah,
I knew the song, but I still was in the parking lot for an hour air drumming. I was like, OK, I need to make sure that I fucking got all these things. Like, I'm a very confident performer, but the pressure of
one song, so unexpected.
I was just like, literally an hour before the show started, they're like, all right, you're going to do that song. It's like, yes. Yes, I am. But so didn't show my concern, but I was immediately like, this has to go fucking incredible. And it did. It really was. I felt like I could fight a grizzly bear once I got off stage. I was like, that is yes, fuck yeah. So
yeah, how do you come down from that? Yeah.
It was amazing. And that was the end of the tour. But so I've maintained a really good friendship with them. They have a new drum tech who's like, he wants to be a drum tech in the way that I want to be a musician. And I'm glad that he has the role. He's amazing at the job. His name's Nikki. Super nice dude, super energetic and passionate. And, you know, I continue to go. I love that band so much. And that crew that like over the summer, just for shits, I went to Amsterdam, Luxembourg and Hellfest outside of Paris just to hang with those guys and go to shows you know, experience it. And I feel very fortunate to be a part of the Nothing More family. And I'll say this for musicians and just people. This is a good rule in life. Like, be a good person. Just be a nice, compassionate human. It's not inauthentic. Like, just care about other people. And that's going to open up more doors than you might expect. Like, if people know you because for one reason that you're just a nice, decent person, like, it's going to do things for you. And I think that that very much applies to you. Like, I think that that is a big part of like what helps like
you, man.
Get people on your show. And like, I feel, even though it can be incredibly difficult and frustrating and full of pitfalls and it can be really expensive and you have no idea what's around the next corner, I'm still incredibly excited to be doing what I'm doing. And I try to never forget that in even the most stressful scenarios. And I it's important for me to like exude that positivity and that gratefulness. And it helps me be mindful of like living in the moment and like still appreciating like, holy shit, man, this is a sold out crowd, or I'm standing in front of 80,000 people, or I get to make music with Clint Lowry, or I'm sitting on the show talking to you after I've been watching your show for several years. Like, it's,
thank you.
They're all very cool moments. So yeah.
When you've been doing Fear of Music for so long now, have you ever had the opportunity to join another band, or was that ever like a temptation, or to keep this one band going? Yeah.
So it's an important question, because it has a lot to do with what I want to do moving forward. So, you know, I recorded an EP essentially with Sahaj Tikitin in December of 2021. And he asked me at the start of that day one of that session, he's like, so you don't have a band. What do you want to do with Fear of Water? And what I told him is what I would tell you is that for me, Fear of Water is first and foremost a artistic vehicle for me for like processing emotions and catharsis and like telling my story and other people's stories in a way that I think is compelling. Secondarily to that is Fear of Water to me is like my audio resume. and I am using, I'm trying to do my best work possible to get in front of the right people in the right place at the right time, because I'm completely open. In fact, I very much so want to like join an established organization that is like signed, touring, like has a, you know, built-in fan base, is going to be recording in the future. Like that is so much more appealing to me than building a band around my music and like, you know, getting in a van and just like living off of our dreams and cigarettes. Like, so like networking with these featured artists, with producers, with engineers, with managers, with festival management, stuff like that. But so I explained that to Sahaj before we record 1 second of music, and he's like, yeah, that's not how that works. I'm like, okay. I mean, that's what I'm going to try to do. Like it's my goal. I understand that it's not conventional, but that's what I'm going to do. And he's like, okay, well, it's, you know, it's your money. Let's go record some music. And then at the end of 3 weeks, after he sees me, here's the songs that I've written, to see me playing guitar and bass and drums and singing and doing the programming and playing keys. And like, he's like, so yeah, I've been thinking about this for the 3 weeks we've been working together. You know, how do you feel about joining Raw? And I was like, I feel pretty fucking good about that, man. Like at no point in time was I thinking recording with Sahaj is going to be a tryout for Raw. It's just a very cool byproduct of pursuing what I'm pursuing. Now, Raw is a very like episodic, like it's not a full-time thing at all. And he makes way more money producing other bands than going out on tour. And like him and I are totally on the same page with that. So it's been a great opportunity for me, but I'm actively seeking a much more serious full-time position. And if you pay attention at all to the music industry, like there are turnover happening in very legit bands all the time. Like things that come to mind right off the top of the head is like Bring Me the Horizon's keyboard player left, Pop Evil's drummer left, Dayseeker's drummer left, you know, Smashing Pumpkins had a guitar player leave. Like there's all of these different examples. Even Butcher Babies, their drummer left. Like I want to be in that. I want to be in that Rolodex. I want to be top of mind the next time one of those opportunities comes up. And like, I am so eager and ready to like bring someone else's music to life and, but bring my, you know, full suite of multi-instrumentalist skills to the table. And also, you know, 20 years of being a professional musician and my tour experience and the fact that I'm like a fully functional, responsible adult and I have no addictions. And like, you know, I check all of these boxes. So like I said, Fear Water is like my audio resume. And this is by talking to you and having music on the air is like, this is my application process. So that's kind of where I'm at. Yeah.
You're the perfect candidate. You know, like I was going to ask you that, you know, vices. You're like, I'm addicted to nothing. You're like, that's pretty amazing.
Well, dude, the thing is, and I've had my shitty phases. You know, I've never like battled addiction, but I've definitely like made bad choices in college. You know, I drank like college kids do.
Yeah.
Well, the irony is that, but it's good, is that my delayed success in music has equipped me with the life experience and the business acumen and the maturity to be able to succeed with longevity moving forward. If I had any of the opportunities in my 20s that I do now, I would have fucked it up for sure. I have no doubt.
Yeah.
That I would have run it into the ground or got burnt out or surrounded myself with the wrong people. Like I just wasn't ready and I would have killed for it, dude. I would have done terrible things to have the opportunity to even be like playing the 1 p.m. set at Aftershock or to be like the third opener on a Seven Dust tour. Like to me, that was everything. I didn't give a shit about anything else. And it was honestly so depressing that I couldn't get out of Wisconsin, that I just felt like I was going nowhere except for I'm continuing to write as much music as possible. I'm continuing to refine my skill set. And it just felt like nothing's happening. So moving to Austin in 2016 was a huge part of like getting out of that rut and starting to network, meeting Mark from Nothing More in 2018, working with Sahaj in 2021. There's a lot of other just examples of that where I've really put myself out there trying to make the best music that I can. I'm always trying to level up and work with the next, you know, a great producer who can help focus my creative talents in a specific way. I'm trying to work with as wide of a variety of featured artists as possible. I'm trying to do as many interviews as possible. I'm trying to like work my social as much as possible. And like, I take this very seriously, but it's been a fun ride so far. It's just been a really long, long, long ride.
A long ride. Yeah. And you keep mentioning this band Raw. I don't know this band. How can people find them? Like where is this band from, Raw? Am I saying that right? How do you spell
it? R-A. I think if you heard this, like, do you call my name?
Okay, I'm going to look it up after this. Okay. I'm going to drop in during the interview. Yes.
And I'm sure the people listening are like yelling at their phone right now. Like, you know this fucking song. Like,
you know it.
Inescapable early, like 2002. It was just one of those songs that like you just couldn't.
I know I'm going to know
away from, yeah. So, and you know, Sahaj, so he, at the time, so the band was formed in LA, and they have quite a few, Do You Call My Name was by far like the best commercial success for them, but they had several other, charting singles, and Sahaj, the lead singer, has continued to put out music under the name of Ra, R-A, since then. And he just keeps getting better and better. But in the meantime, he's been working with like Motley Crue and Starset and Bad Wolves and Nothing More. And he, like, his name is attached to some very serious, successful music. And he's a phenomenal writer and producer. So working with him was amazing. And then getting the opportunity to play and tour with him, as well as the other bandmates, was incredible. And like, all of these things are just, you know, I look at it as like, I'm a snowball on the top of a mountain and I'm going down and I'm just picking up speed and the ball's getting bigger. And I'm trying to say yes to as many smart opportunities as possible. But like, Ra is very, it's like this like Middle Eastern influenced Egyptian new metal. As like a fan of Korn, like there's, I guarantee you're gonna love this band if you don't know them.
I, and it's just
like, the light bulb's not going off, but like,
usually what happens.
But like, it's like I said, that's a, it's a temporary thing. He just like doesn't really tour at all except for like select opportunities. He's not really putting out new music because it just makes so much more sense to work with other bands, and his studio is at his home, so he gets to be with his wife and his child. And I, you know, I get it. And he's in his like mid 50s, so like, you know, that part of his life is not as active as like where I'm at in life right now, where I'm like, put me out there, dude. Like, I'm sitting on the bench and like, put me in, coach. But in the meantime, you know, I'm going to just keep doing these collaborations and working with, like at the end of this month, I'm going to be working with, Joseph McQueen, who has done all of, Howard Jones of Killswitch Engage. He's done like Light the Torch and Scion and, those kind of projects and Bad Wolves, and he's incredible. Like, the stuff that he puts out sounds enormous. And I'm gonna dip into that, and you know, after, I'm gonna do three songs with him, and then who knows, maybe I'm working with Wizard Blood or Elvis, you know, that Seven Dust Works, you know, they've done
Elvis.
So he's absolutely on the list, and I'm gonna just keep doing this and see what doors it opens up. And honestly, even if it doesn't, even if I don't achieve the thing that I've just described to you, it will, this is still so satisfactory and fulfilling to be able to create music that I'm so proud of and be able to share it with you and everyone else who's listening, and having this opportunity to work with these artists has been great, dude.
Bones, I was talking to Bones from Stuck Mojo, and he had an idea. I don't know if it's fruition. I don't know what's going on with it, but it reminds me of what you're doing, because he was like, I'm going to do an album called Bones and Friends. And every song is just collaborating with a different artist, man.
Someone recently called me the Carlos Santana of metal. So I was like, I'll take that, man. I got to call Rob Thomas and like do
that's
a song
so
with him.
That's so funny. Yeah.
Dude, speaking of Stuck Mojo, 2 weeks ago, I sat down with Lord Nelson.
Lord Nelson, big shout out. Great interview.
Dude, so his energy, I just got goosebumps again thinking, like, I could have talked to that guy for 5 hours. Like, he was just so like... He's awesome, man. Like, he keeps it going. He's very invested in what he's saying. His energy and lifelong love of music is so ubiquitous throughout like every single thing that he says. And it's a joy to connect with someone like that. He's just so deeply ingrained.
Absolutely. And he, you know, he was the after Bones, he fronted Stuck Mojo for people don't know, you know?
Yeah. Tremendous performer. Absolutely. And I told him, I was like, dude, I've like middle school, high school, Dave, has seen you. Like, I've seen Stuck Mojo so many different times throughout the years, because they've so done those circuits with like, being religious about following Seven Dust has introduced me to so many other bands that I still love to this day, which has been great. But definitely I've got introduced to Stuck Mojo, I'm sure, through one of the 500,000 tours that Seven Dust has done. So
Lord Nelson, you know, and during when he was interviewing, he was like, I'd like to be in that camp. I like to work with you. I was thinking like, that would be so cool, you know, to have him rhyme over some of your stuff. That'd be really cool.
And that was not like lip service. Like, if like, I want to work with as many people as possible. The one caveat to that is that, like, not to sound, not, it's not like elitist, but like, I need to be working with people who can get me in front of their fan bases. Like, this is part of like a step, you know, like I said, it's my resume. Exactly. This is my form of like audio networking. And I really hope to one day be able to pay that forward when I'm in a position, when an independent artist who's making music out of his spare bedroom reaches out to me and I'm able to provide the type of, you know, exposure that could help them. You know, it's, I think that that's so important in so many different creative endeavors to like not close the door behind you, as they say. So I would take great pride in being able to help others someday. That'd be great.
I love that, dude, man. We're very similar. When you left for when you left Wisconsin and went to Texas, are you close to your family? I mean, was that, that's a huge thing moving, right?
Yeah. I mean, so tell that to the rest of my family, because they had all left before me, man. I was the last person there. Every single one left. And I'm the youngest. So like, I got out of college the latest. And like, I was also just a crazy poor, like so poor. So I was living in my friend's attic, sleeping on a mattress on the ground that came with the house when they bought it. It was a room that had one outlet in it with two plugs. But it couldn't handle, the house was built in the like early 1800s. So I could either have a light on or a space heater on, but not both at the time. And this is an attic without insulation in the middle of winter in Wisconsin. Like, I've roughed it out, dude. Like, I've paid my dues in terms of, I've done like the rock star grungy thing with none of the glory for a very long time. So like, I feel like I've paid my dues. You know, I've been able to achieve, you know, business success from a marketing perspective. I opened my own ad agency after, running social media departments for huge ad agencies for the better part of a decade, started my own agency, which allowed me the work-life balance to be able to invest in taking bigger swings and working with bigger people. And then like even going out with nothing more was a huge pay cut for me. And that's not to say anything about like they're underpaying their people. It's just that like, I've been very successful with my agency, but I like completely stepped away from that so I could completely dedicate myself to an artistic endeavor. And that's, I'm very fortunate that I'm in a position to do that. It almost makes you feel, I get imposter syndrome all the time. Do you ever have that feeling?
Oh God. Yeah, I do. And a lot of people do. A lot of people I interview have that. Yeah. That's a common, you get that too?
Oh dude. So much. There's this part of me that feels like I need to close my company down. If all of my eggs are not in this basket, then I'm not as committed as other people who is like, it's this or nothing. I feel that all the time. When I see like streaming numbers skyrocket, I'm like, I don't get it. When a huge thing for me is when Codependent Parasites started climbing the charts, I had until it was on Octane 3 months later, I'd never once heard it on the radio. So there's this huge voice going off in my head is like, this isn't real. You haven't heard it on the radio. You're just looking at some chart from some company that you have no connection to. And you're next to all these bands that you've been listening to for 25 years that have huge fan bases and professional record labels behind them. There's no reason that you should be playing in the same sandbox. I struggle with that feeling every day. And
you're not on tour. So you're not seeing fans in front of you. Exactly.
That's a huge thing. I don't have that, like, I'm getting like mathematical validation, not human interaction. I'm not talking to fans by the merch table. I'm not hearing people sing the music back to me. Yeah, dude. So like, it is a very real thing. I will say it does keep me humble. And even hearing like in the interview that you were doing with Clint, where he was talking about, like, I think he is, and I'm not alone in this, thinking that he is just such a masterful songwriter and he has so much passion and so much talent, but to hear him talk about getting like shy on stage and being uncomfortable being a front man. Yeah. I was like, what are you talking about, dude? How could you possibly feel that way? First of all, after doing it your whole life and being so objectively good by so many metrics, there's something comforting hearing your heroes be like, I struggle in this way too. So like, it's a very real thing. So yeah.
Oh, I've heard that before too, man. That's wild. I've felt that as well. You know, you and I are probably the same age and everything. I love music from the 90s and like the first bands that got me into metal and I love everything though. Yeah.
And the 90s is where my heart will always be. Like, I'm so rooted in that. Yeah.
I've heard you mention like the Smash, my Offspring. That's a classic for me. And Nirvana and Pretty Hate Machine and, you know, all these bands. Me and you listen to the same thing. What was the band that got you started? Like, what's the earliest album you can think of that, you know, we got you influenced?
So the first, do you remember the first CD that you bought?
Yeah, I do. It's kind of embarrassing.
Oh, mine too. That's why I'm laughing.
All right.
Mine is Tom Cochran, the Life is a Highway. That was my first album. I couldn't name another song off of that album if you paid me $1 billion. I have no memory.
That's the only song. Mine was the Bodyguard soundtrack, the Whitney Houston. Dude. I Will Always Love You soundtrack.
That's so funny. Like, why do you think, was it because of the Whitney song? Like, what was it about that you wanted?
I played baseball and that was like the hottest movie, and CDs were brand new, and it was just like, here's this album. Yeah, there we go. But anyway,
influence on me whatsoever. I just very vividly remember being like, because also just like having a CD, it's crazy, dude. We are definitely the same age. Like when I got my first like Discman, I was like, holy shit, man. Like I've been listening to cassettes. This is bullshit. But definitely Nevermind by Nirvana is the most impactful album on me. And I went through this really critical transition as I fell in love with this album, which is, I started off as I think the overwhelming majority of music consumers do, where it's like you care most about the lead singer, his voice, and like the song as a whole, right? So it's like, if you asked me, dude, this is like literally second or third grade, so I'd be like, I love Kurt Cobain, or like, you know, Smells Like Teen Spirit is a cool song. I would have never mentioned Dave Grohl during that time period. I'm gonna mention something about me that's really hard to summarize, but it's but in general, something, an important thing to know about me is that I was born clinically deaf, and I went through this enormous recovery process that took well over 10 years to get functional hearing back and then catch up cognitively, because I was so far behind everyone else, and music was a huge part of that recovery. And in fourth grade, everyone in my grade school got a chance to try out for band, and I wanted to play saxophone so bad. I don't remember why, it just seemed like the coolest instrument. And during the tryout process, everyone goes through the same thing where you get this plastic recorder. It's like a plastic flute with three holes on it, and you play like Hot Cross Buns or Jingle Bells or something like that. And I fucking bombed so hard. Like I could not do it. I couldn't read music. I didn't have the hand-eye coordination. I was terrible. And my band teacher could tell how badly I wanted this, but also that I was fully aware of the fact that I sucked so bad. And he told me, and I appreciate this, so if I could get into a time machine and hug this man, I would. He told me that I didn't have no concept of a saxophone, like the engineering of it, but he's like, if you struggle with the three notes on a song flute on a recorder, a saxophone will make you want to quit music. It is so complicated and convoluted, and it requires both hands, and there's like 45 buttons on it. And the last thing I want you to do is end your relationship with music before it starts. So I think you'd be better suited to be in the percussion section and see if you can thrive there, and we'll go from there. And at first I was so resentful. I was like, fuck you, man. Like, this is bullshit. Like, I totally viewed it as like the detention center of band. Like, you just stuffing people in the back of the room.
Yeah, you got demoted at that point. Exactly, in your mind.
Dude, I totally viewed it as that. And then 2 weeks into band, when we started like playing some songs, I remember we played like the Jurassic Park theme song. I realized that I'm not in the back. I'm in the driver's seat. I realized that the 50 kids in front of me, that even though they aren't facing me, they're following me and my fellow percussionists. And I realized that all of the power and drive and tempo and dynamic, like you are the cue for like, this is a big part, this is a soft part, is all coming from the back of the room, is all coming from the percussion. And that totally changed the way that I heard all music. And I went back to Nevermind and I was like, oh, the reason I really love Nevermind is Dave Grohl is absolutely ripping all of our faces off. I was also listening to like Metallica and other bands at that time that had big drum sounds, but there's something so specifically tasty about what Dave Grohl does. And I realized this is what I'm really sinking my teeth into. And that inspired me to like get my first total piece of shit drum set and just start to try to teach myself. And it was an incredibly difficult process, but like from that moment on, Dave Grohl has been the number one guy for me in terms of like inspiring me and like seeing him, the fact that so many decades later, he's not only like still making music, but Foo Fighters is arguably the biggest rock band in the world. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He's done all these amazing documentaries. He's worked with so many cool artists. Like, I feel very fortunate to this much later in life, past my childhood, still that the fact that I can still see Tool, the fact that Nine Inch Nails is still doing incredible stuff, that Seven Dust and Nonpoint are still, these are like core youth memories for me. And those guys are still out there crushing it. These aren't guys who are like retired and play twice a year at a state fair or something. Like, they're doing it. They're still leading the charge. Yeah. They're still making
some of the best music. They're keeping us motivated. Are you motivated?
Dude. Like, no, for you too, dude. Like, that's what I'm saying. It's like, you are on the front lines in your own creative way. And obviously you care enough about like what they represent and their history and their future that you want to have them on your show. Like, it matters a lot. New music is also really great and important, but like, having these men and women who've been around for so long and survived some of the worst parts of the music industry and have survived like even the like suicide of your lead singer or something like that. We need more people like that to help keep our music authentic and grounded and connected to the human experience, instead of just being this like commercial factory of like how many songs that sound exactly like the last Bring Me Horizon single can we pump out. So I just realized I have my good company hoodie.
Yes. Right.
I just looked behind me. I was like, oh shit, that's
my dude. I sent you that. I'm
you
totally
did send me that.
It.
I didn't know if you were gonna remember that. Yeah, man. Like you, yeah. I messaged you like a while ago. I've been following you for a long time.
Yeah,
like,
that's a long time ago.
That's another thing. You do a good job of being an ambassador of not only the industry, but like the genre specifically and the fan community. And you just do a good job of like evangelizing yourself. Dude, I thought so that much. It meant a lot to me to like get stickers and a hoodie. You had nothing to gain from giving. I don't have any like leverage or whatever. So yeah, it was great.
No.
It stuck with me for sure. Yeah.
Thank you so much, man. That means a lot to me.
That's what I'm saying.
Thank you, man. You are too. And this is maybe a silly question, but when I was kind of researching all the stuff you've done, yep. I can't help but to go on YouTube and you type Fear of Water and you don't type band. You get a whole lot of Fear of People, Fear of Water.
You do. You do. Yeah.
Where did this name come from? Fear of Water.
So Fear of Water, touched on that a little bit at the beginning of our discussion here, but like,
oh yes.
But like really what it's truly rooted in is that, I mean, this goes back to high school. I would never have, I was never like a loner, but I never had any sort of clique. I never had like a phase or a group of people that I identified. I had friends, but like, I really struggled with, it's important for me to be humble. And I never say something that likes to be like, I was cool before everyone else. I was acutely aware of the like groupings of people that there was this, like, we were making our own society 7 hours a day, 5 days a week in this high school. And it like bothered me immediately that there was this hierarchy of like, oh, these are hot chicks and these are like plain girls, or like,
that's how it was.
These are jocks. Preppy. And like, these are goth people. And like, they get their ass kicked after school. I was like, why is this happening? Like, we're all going through puberty at the same time. We're all dealing with a lot of the same shit. And I never adhered to any of that. And there were downfalls of that. Like, this sounds petty, but at the time, high school is your whole life. So like, there'd be parties all the time I'm not getting invited to, or there'd be like, girls who'd be uncomfortable about like me asking them out or whatever, because they couldn't even like, who are you? Like, what's your thing? What's your identity? Why don't you have like, why aren't you a skater kid? Or why aren't you a jock? Or why don't you have some sort of defined thing that I can connect to these preconceived notions of what kids should be? And that construct absolutely continues when we get out of high school. It gets diluted by a bunch of other things and we end up living our entire lives that way. And I fucking hate it.
Yeah.
And a lot of bad stuff comes from that. So as early as high school, I was writing under the name of Fear of Water. And then what that is it's a reference to the body being composed of 70-80% water. And it's the fear of like being, not only being true to yourself, but living yourself, embracing what you are actually made out of and sharing that with the world. Even in the face of it being rejected, even if you know for a fact that this isn't what's popular, trendy, mainstream, if this is going to make you an other or an outcast, I think, and it's hard to have perspective as a 16-year-old, but a life well lived is a life where you know yourself and you can articulate that to yourself when you're alone in your thoughts, or you're with your loved ones, or, you know, as you find your community later in life. Like, the more at peace you are with yourself and embrace your weirdness and your idiosyncrasies and all of these things, like, you're going to be a happier, more fulfilled person. It's all about quality over quantity in almost everything in life. So Fear of Water is absolutely about acknowledging the reality of that fear of what it means to not conform, confronting it, giving it a name, embracing the fact that we're all susceptible to it, and then acting in this truly dignified way of be like, no, that's not who I am. Like, I get that this is what's popular, but like, this is what I believe in. This is where I come from. This is my water, and I'm going to proudly speak it and wear it or say it or sing it or whatever your medium is. That's been a huge driving force for like a lot of my writing, is just that I'm not saying like fuck Western society and go live in a convent somewhere, but like, it's just, there is not enough encouragement. There's just so many arbiters of what's cool in so many different areas of life. And so much is about like, it's our group and your group and what's cool and what's not, and you're sexy and you're not, and this is in and this is out. And it's like, those things can still exist, but shouldn't actually define people's entire identity. It shouldn't make them feel bad about themselves. And yeah, for me, Fear of Water is a conversation about that whole phenomenon that I think impacts almost every single person alive.
That's one hell of an answer, man. That's amazing.
Thank you.
That is great. Kind of
sometimes I just say like I fell in a pool once when I was 5 and it really scared me. You know, sometimes I don't want to give the whole diatribe, but yeah, man, that's the real answer.
No, that real answer is great. What's your future like? What's going on? You got the Clint Lowry song coming out. When is that coming out?
There's not a set date. I'm very cognizant of like, it's easier for one of my collaborative partners to be an active part of the like release of it and the promotion and whatnot when they're not on tour. And Seven Dust has been pretty active. They always have their New Year's shows, and they've been pretty active in 2024 so far. So I've been mindful of like, I would like Clint to have like a at home stretch of time when I release that song, so he can like be a part of it as well. And I'm not hitting him up while he's like getting 4 hours of sleep in between shows and be like, hey man, can you make some posts? Like, I want to be very considerate of that. Right. And fortunately, I have a lot of other good things going on and other pieces of music and collaborations that are in the works, that there's plenty to fill the pipeline. I've even just today started talking to someone who I'm incredibly excited about, and I don't want to say anything until it's confirmed, but like, there's still some really exciting opportunities out there in terms of who I'm connecting with to make new music. And yeah, I'm gonna just keep doing that. So I have the song with Clint, and I have a song featuring Sahaj Tikitin of Raw, which you're going to check out as soon as we're done talking.
Check it out. I know this song.
I have a bunch of other songs in the works, and I'm going to just keep doing this. Going to keep making like what I hope to be is interesting music videos. Like I just released yesterday a music video for One Day featuring Heidi Shepherd of Butcher Babies. And this sounds weird. It is modern ballet. And I'd never done anything like this before. I found a choreography group that had some really cool video examples. I sent them the song and I was like, I want to sit down with you and go line by line through this entire song and tell you what part of my heart that this comes from and what it means to me. And it's about this relationship between me and my mom and the inevitability of her death and what we all go through and losing our parents. It's one of the hardest things in life, but it's also such a universal experience. And it's like, can you tell that story through dance? And they stepped up to the challenge in a big way. Like, I'm so proud of how that turned out. And then like the video that you saw, where it's like four clones of me in a room playing together. Like, I want to do interesting music videos to go along with what I hope is interesting music for a guy that's in an interesting, unconventional position. And I'm going to just keep doing this until maybe nothing happens, but I'm going to keep putting out what I think is really good music and doing what I can to support it and exploring different, you know, parts of the creative universe. And yeah, man, I'm just going for it, whatever that is.
I'm sorry about the loss of your mom. That's terrible, man. Sorry about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's,
is that what that song's about, though? One Day? You said that?
One Day.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
And I just, I'm gonna
go
really
back and listen to it now.
It really struck me that, it seems so obvious, but it's also so profound that, like, barring some sort of tragedy where we die before our parents, like, we will all lose the people who brought us into this world and, like, in a lot of cases, made us the men and women who we are and, like, who we literally depended on for our survival. And my mom and I went through some very, very tough experiences together. I had an incredibly abusive, alcoholic, bipolar father, and she saved me and my brothers from that and got us out of there. And we were homeless for a while and we were all separated for a long time, but she knew like I have to, like, she literally saved our lives. And that, you know, I grew up real fast during that time period, and we've had this blend of like, she's my mom, but she's also like such a good friend to me as well. And, you know, we've gone through so much together, which is a blessing, but it also puts so much weight on that connection that I have, like, two parents worth of relationships in this one woman, and we've gone through so much together that the inevitability of her death was such like a prolonged, like every funeral I ever went to, I was like, that's gonna be my mom one day. Like I couldn't, that thought was so pervasive that I couldn't get away from it. And I explained this to Sahaj, and he really helped me write music around that. It's not my process. I usually like write music, just whatever flows out of me, and then go back from a lyrical standpoint and be like, what kind of emotion is elicited by this music? But in this case, I've just really been, especially coming out of COVID, I was just dealing with like, my mom's gonna die. Like I couldn't stop thinking about it. It was like compulsive. And he really helped me articulate that feeling, as well as focus on like cherishing the time that we have and being grateful for that. And speaking of being grateful, I cannot say enough thanks to Heidi from Butcher Babies for coming on board. At first, I have to admit, I was skeptical because she's such a brutal badass of a performer. I was like, how is this titan of metal?
Yeah,
exactly. And she came in and she gave this unbelievably vulnerable, emotional performance that took this song to exactly to what it needed to be. And again, just like the other collaborators, she's been such an active participant in the creative process, in promoting it. She'll just like randomly send me a text message and just be like, hey, I woke up and the song was in my head. Thank you so much for having me be a part of this. I'm like, that means everything to me, dude. Like, it's so cool. But anyways, I'm just going to keep doing this stuff. And if other people connect with it, amazing. Like if this helps someone else grieve the loss of their parents, that's amazing for me. Even if I don't ever make a dollar off of it, like it's way more important for me to like create something that other people can emotionally connect with.
I'm sure they will. And that's a beautiful thing, man. That yeah, that means a lot. I mean,
Thank you.
I have my mom, but that's just, I don't know, man.
Well, it means a lot for you to have me on the show, man. It really, it feels good to, I don't know, it feels kind of weird to keep kicking that dead horse, but like it means a lot to me to be on here talking to you after watching so many of your episodes. And I really have felt for a long time that you and I are on a parallel path of like, we're both kind of grassrootsing it. We were both huge music fans, and we're kind of expressing that in our own ways, but without a huge support network and a full team behind us. And yeah, man, I just have a lot of respect for what you're doing, but I appreciate you having me be a part of that.
Thank you. And same to you, man. I'm that means a lot to me that you have a lot of respect for me, because I love what you're doing, and it's very impressive and motivating. Just hearing you, I'm like, God, I need to do more.
You're doing plenty, man. I promise.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate being on the show, Dave. Let's keep in touch, man. I'd love to have you back on, maybe co-host or something.
Dude, I would love that. I would love to be a part of one of your conversations with other artists, man. Like I truly enjoy just connecting with really passionate people who have interesting stories, who are a part of the world that you and I love so much. So yeah, man.
Yeah, you're a great communicator. Yeah, that'd be great.
Thank you, dude. I appreciate it.
All right, brother.
All right, dude, stay in touch. I'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thank you so much, Dave Pair. Appreciate it, man.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it's been great.